I'm going to start off with some pictures. The title of my sermon is Anger Management. These kind of relate. All right, let's see the first one. Now, apparently this child's father is a graphic designer. Let's see the next one. Ooh. Moving along. No, you didn't see that one. Go to the next one. There you go. Okay, I'll go again. And one more. Oh. All right. There's my gratuitous humor for the morning. But anyway, the idea for this sermon has been... Molly. There's no resemblance, I hope. The idea for this sermon has been brewing in my mind for a while. And I'm not sure how it started, but I've come to the realization that I may have a temper. I can really get mad. Now, luckily, I'm also a chicken and a coward, therefore I don't act out that anger, or maybe I just have good self-control, take what you will. So I don't think that most people really know when Ryan's mad. Therefore, I was under the assumption that I'm pretty good at holding my temper and not getting angry. Well, I've been disposed of that view by my lovely wife, Chris, who in four, almost 5 years of marriage now, has come to recognize the signs. The scenario is usually pretty pathetic, pretty weak. My anger usually doesn't have roots in the situation at hand. It's usually because, if you think back, it's because I'm tired or had a rough day or whatever. But it's always something rather piddly that sets me off. This is one of my favorites. I wipe the kitchen table off, okay? Only to notice Chris, who thinks I'm not watching, sigh her pretty little sigh, walk over, and wipe it off again. That makes me furious. That really makes me angry. After Chris read this, she says, I know you're watching. Anyway, and I'm like, I just did that. Do you have to be that particular, you know? I usually don't say that. I usually don't do much of anything. I just get kind of more jerky in my movements, a little more abrupt, and don't say a whole lot. And it doesn't escape her. After a few minutes, she'll say, you're furious with me right now, aren't you? And I'm like, no, you don't know what furious is, honey. And in that statement, I realize, she's right. I'm mad. And I think it's moments like that that lead Chris to say she's very glad that I don't drink, because she thinks that I'd be a very angry drunk. I think I'd be a happy-go-lucky one, but we'll never know. So, but there's something that feels good about being angry, about being mad, about letting that go, you know? So I thought for this sermon we'd take a look at Jesus and try to figure out, when is it okay to be angry? Following Christ's example, when should we be angry? So if you want to follow along, we're going to be in Matthew, starting in chapter 4. We're going to skip around a lot, so you can listen or follow. I'm not particular. Chapter 4, verse 10, is the first time I found that Jesus seemed angry. Jesus said to him, away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. And I almost didn't put this in there because he only seems slightly miffed. But it seems like he was angry. And so it's okay to be angry with Satan. Okay, that's kind of a no-brainer. So let's turn further in Matthew to Matthew 12, 38 to 39. Then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law said to him, Teacher, we want to see a miraculous sign from you. He answered, A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. Now, I'm making a little bit of a leap here. I guess it is possible to say that statement without anger. A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign. But it makes more sense to me if it comes out something more like, A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign. I mean, it seems like Jesus is angry with the Pharisees. Going along to Matthew 16, a similar passage. Everyone's turning furiously. The Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. He replied, "When evening comes, you'll say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning today, it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation looks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah." And if you're confused by that statement, in the previous passage, the next couple of verses say how Jesus equated Jonah's being in the fish for 3 days and three nights and his being in the tomb for 3 days and three nights. So that's what that means, but it's not part of the sermon today. So the same question from the same group of people, and they got the same answer. So once again, Jesus is angry with the religious leaders. Moving on to Matthew 17. And don't worry, we're just looking through Matthew, not the whole New Testament. So, starting in verse 14. "When they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. 'Lord, have mercy on my son,' he said. 'He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into fire or into water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him.' 'Oh, unbelieving and perverse generation,' Jesus replied, 'how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you?'" So this time, Jesus seems upset with the disciples, almost exasperated. Reading a little bit further, it seems that he was upset more over their lack of faith. I'm not sure how angry he was in that one. So moving on to Matthew 21. This is the one I usually think of when I think of Jesus getting angry, especially since in this one, Jesus took action. Verse 12, Jesus entered the temple area and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. "It is written," he said to them, "my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers." Now, once again, who is he angry at? He's angry at those selling doves and sacrifices in the temple. But who allowed that? Well, it was the religious leaders once again, and they're probably getting a decent cut. So, once again, he's mad, angry at the religious leaders who are using the temple to sell for profit. And now our last one. Oh, nope, not the last one. Matthew 22, not the last one. Verses 15 through 17. The Pharisees are trying to trap him by asking the question, "Should you pay your taxes to Caesar?" And they're trying to trap him because, depending on what answer they think he'll give, he'll either make the Romans mad, so they can turn him into the Romans, or he'll make the Jews mad. And he answers in verse 18, "But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, 'You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me?'" Here it seems that he is angry with them for having evil intent towards him, but probably more because they were hypocrites. It makes me wonder how they would have answered that question had it been asked to them about whether it's right to pay taxes. My guess is it probably would depend on who is asking the question. They probably railed against the Romans to the Jews, but made sure their taxes were paid so they wouldn't get in trouble with the Romans. That's my guess. And the last one this morning, and it's a doozy, is most of chapter 23 in Matthew. Things seem to really come to a head for Jesus concerning the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, and he just lets them have it throughout that whole chapter. When Sean and I would fight when we were younger, I got a pretty good picture of ascending rage from Sean. I would do something, he would get mad at me and take a swing, and since I was always much bigger than him, still am, I just can't catch him anymore, I would wrap him up in my arms and just hold him so he couldn't move. And he'd be like 2 inches from my face. And his face would get redder and redder until it was purple. And he'd be shaking in my arms. And he would just get louder and screaming louder. And I knew that pretty much the only thing I could do was hold him until he was too tired to move or let him go and run. So, anyway, also made me think of road rage. They say that road rage often, when something happens where someone actually beats somebody up, there's usually an ascension, a progression. So they'll make eye contact, and then they'll make gestures and cussing, and then finally someone gets out and fixes the problem, sort of. Interesting enough, I was looking up road rage, and the U.S. is number one of all the countries. We have the most incidences of road rage. However, I also found it kind of curious that in different categories, other countries were ahead of us, which is good, I guess. Like the one where the making obscene gestures and language, the Australians were ahead of everybody by like 20%. I don't know what that means. But the road rage was really low. Maybe they didn't know how to vent. Anywho, where was I? progression of anger. So throughout Matthew, the Pharisees had been pestering Jesus, and it has escalated to chapter 23 here. He lays out seven woes to the Pharisees, and we're going to take them one at a time. Verses 1 through 12, it's sort of leading up to it. He's calling them self-righteous hypocrites who do more harm than good. And then we hit verse 13. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. So what are they doing? Well, they're keeping people from the kingdom of heaven. See why Jesus would be angry with them. And they're doing that by, and you had to think about this a little bit, they're doing it by denying Christ. So that's keeping them from the gates of heaven, kingdom of heaven. And then they're using their influence on others to convince them that Jesus is a fraud. So they're keeping others from entering the kingdom of heaven. Woe number 2, verse 15. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are. Now, don't confuse this with missions. It's worth whatever it takes to win people to the cause of Christ. But the curious thing here is the Pharisees were not converting non-Jews to Judaism. They're converting Jews to Phariseeism, which I'm pretty sure isn't a word, but you know what I'm talking about. Remember, talking to non-Jews and Gentiles was strongly discouraged, and the Pharisees were really big into making sure they weren't unclean. They were converting Jews to their way of thinking. It'd be kind of like me spending all of my time and energy trying to convert Baptists. Not to Christianity, because they're already there, but to convert them to my way of thinking. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be debate, although I'm not big on debate, I guess be more. I'm not saying there shouldn't be debate, but just be careful what you are spending your energy and time on, and also what message you are trying to bring to someone. Am I trying to bring someone to Jesus or to Ryanism? Another made-up word. Woe number 3, verse 16. Woe to you blind guides! You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools! Any question about whether he's angry? You don't usually call people fools unless you're a little miffed. Which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift on it, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And he who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. Jesus is inferring that they are making a mockery of the very scriptures that they claim to uphold. They're missing the point and the boat. They're nitpicky. They're making up their own rules, kind of. It's kind of like saying that, it's the cheese that makes a sandwich, when we all know that without the bread, it's just a piece of cheese. Anyway, now I'm hungry. Woe number 4. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, But you've neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. You blind guides, you strain out the gnat but swallow the camel. Once again, it's saying that they're missing it. They're nitpicking on the little things. They follow the law. They love to study the law, all the little details, and do everything it says, but they're neglecting the big picture, what the law adds up to, the justice, the mercy, the faithfulness. Woe numbers 5 and 6 are similar, so we're going to take them at once. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside also will be clean. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You're like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. It's the idea that they focus. They care more about how they look and how they're perceived than how they actually are. Basically, the definition of hypocrisy being something that you're not. Found it very interesting on the second one, the second woe I mentioned there, which is woe number 6. Apparently, the Pharisees had an obsession with staying away from corpses or anything to do with graves, tombs, because that makes you unclean, and they're very big on that. So to call them tombs full of dead men's bones was quite insulting. Woe number 7. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous. And you say, if we had lived in the days of our forefathers, we would not have taken part with them in the shedding of the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up, then, the measure of the sin of your forefathers. And he is once again pointing out their hypocrisy. They were big on building monuments and tombs and decorating the tombs of righteous religious figures of old, piously saying that they would not have helped to kill them. And yet, here they are, ironically, planning to kill Jesus. Jesus concludes his discourse with the scathing ending, starting in verse 33. You snakes, you brood of vipers, how will you escape being condemned to hell? Therefore I'm sending you prophets and wise men and teachers. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. And so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. I tell you the truth, all this will come upon this generation. So what got Jesus angry, at least in the book of Matthew? Hypocrisy and self-righteousness are what made him mad. The idea that someone knows all the answers are completely right, when in truth they are not. And I think it bothered Jesus so much, it made him so mad, because if you think about all the people that the Pharisees were leading astray with their position of power, it's a warning to leaders to make sure that you are humble and leading people where God wants them to go. Notice Jesus was never mad or angry at a sinner who knew what he was, that he was a sinner, and he knew what he was doing was wrong and wanted to fix it. When I was in Alaska, the missionaries told me that the one thing that I could never do in front of the native peoples was to lose my temper. To them, that was the ultimate failure, and they wouldn't pay any attention to you after that, because they could keep their temper. You know. I think that's sort of true of most everyone. If someone you don't know blows up in front of you, it kind of takes a while to regain the trust in them. I think it's a little different within families because you know each other so well. There's a little more give and take there. But for someone you don't know, someone who is not a Christian, think of how your testimony could be hurt if you're yelling at your kids out in your front yard and the neighbors are watching. I mean, I wonder how many souls may have been lost to Christians' anger. So Jesus got angry at self-righteousness and hypocrisy. And remember, the question I asked was, when should we get angry? When should we get mad? So that's it. That's a thing we're allowed to get angry about. Self-righteousness. Now, as I read this, I realized something. There's no go and do likewise at the end of the passage. It's not there. I don't think this is something that we're supposed to emulate Christ's example on. I'm not to say that we shouldn't be on the lookout for self-righteousness and to watch for it, but angry? First off, Jesus is God, and he can do things that we're not supposed to, being God. And if you think about it, only a sinless person, only someone without sin, has the right to be mad about someone else claiming to be right when they're wrong. You know? Jesus knew they weren't right, and that he was. And he's the only one who can claim that totally, you know? Secondly, the Bible does tell us how to deal with other believers, other members of the body, and it doesn't really tell us to get mad at them. The greatest fruit of the Spirit is love. The Bible tells us many times to dwell together in unity. In our dealings with others, do everything with love. Proverbs is full of verses that tell us to be slow to anger. Now, I always found that a little confusing because people tell you not to bottle it up inside because then it'll just blow up. Well, I don't think slow to anger is necessarily bottling it up inside. I think it's more in every situation, taking your time, taking a time out. Don't get angry fast. Because oftentimes, if you take your time, you won't get angry at all. A warning from this book in Matthew 5:22, I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Now think about that in your relationships. Something else was brought out by the sermon that I wasn't necessarily intending. I actually figured that I would find some ways that when it'd be right to be okay to be a little bit angry. But it also brings out the idea that self-righteousness is the only thing that Jesus got mad at. And I know that I have been self-righteous a time or two. Think about it, Christ didn't get angry when he was being dragged to the cross. At least it doesn't say. He was very peaceable about it. So it's a warning to us that don't be self-righteous. Don't be pious. We're all in the same boat. We're all sinners. I'm going to read one more verse before we close. John 13:34-35. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Let's pray. Lord, it is seemingly to me impossible not to get angry. For a human being to never get angry. So I'm not saying that, but I pray that when we get angry, when we lose our cool, Father, that you would be there with us, that you would guide our outward responses, that you would help us to be slow to show that, to temper our anger, to guide it into peaceful passages and energy, and forgive us for when we fail in this, because I know we're going to. I know I'm going to. Lord, I pray that we would be able to capture the fruits of the Spirit, the love, the joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and the self-control that you provide to us through your Spirit. And this week, when situations arise that start to make us angry, I pray that we will remember that others are watching, and that our example will be seen. Help us not to distract from you, from your message. We pray that you would shine through us. In your name, amen.